This is Margaret Cho, and you're listening to the Bicast, podcasting for the bisexual community.
Welcome to the Bicast, a podcast for the bisexual community. We recently ran across this article on Bi Magazine submitted by Anil Vora about this astounding woman, Gloria Jackson Nefertiti. Welcome, Gloria.
Thank you. Hi.
Welcome.
Hi.
We are really glad to have you here today. Right. You've had quite an amazing journey. Can you tell us a little about yourself?
Oh, boy. Well, I'm originally from the Deep South, from Mississippi, actually. And I was a fundamentalist Christian for many years. But I left the church in the early 1980s after just seeing so much hypocrisy and misogyny. Well, and more recently, so much racism.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In the late 70s, I was a student at Portland State University, and I had joined this group that, you know, I thought was, basically an evangelistic type group, a campus ministry, and it really turned out to be a cult. Which was really, really scary for me. I mean, obviously, you know, it wasn't something that I saw at the very beginning, but as time went on, I noticed certain things, like, for instance, this is so hard to imagine in this day and age, but for most of the people in the group, I was the first black person they had ever known. Mm. I mean, I was the only black person in the group, you know, and it became obvious after a while, you know, that their standards for me were much different from the standards, you know, that they had for everybody else in the group. One of the ways that I realized that it was a cult is that it eventually got to the point where other Christians didn't like us. because it's like we were the only ones who were really evangelizing and really following the Bible, you know, everybody else was wrong. It was basically us against them.
Right. And, you know, and I grew up in Salem, Oregon during the 70s. And so I think I know which group you're talking about because I had a family member involved with them.
Oh, my gosh.
And so I know exactly what you're talking about.
Oh, wow.
And especially I know exactly what you're talking about the racial lack of racial diversity.
Yes.
As, you know, and if you think it was bad in Portland, if you lived in Salem, we could count the black families that lived in town.
Oh my goodness.
Our family was, you know, very good friends with them. So,
mm-hmm.
So we're very aware of what, what was going on.
Oh my goodness.
So it sounds weird now. I know it sounds very odd to hear people say that, but it was not that long ago.
Right. Right. I know.
Yeah.
And I, constantly felt like the other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I was always different, you know, I just never quite fit in, you know.
And you talked a little bit about the fact that they kind of made you the representative of the black people.
Yes,
and,
yes, exactly.
You know, like, and you felt like you had to explain them and all these things. And, you
right.
know, one of the things I really like about the whole white privilege thing now is,
uh-huh.
is, you know, say, you know, it's not the black person's, you're the person standing next to you to keep explaining to you why, you know, it's a problem. It's just a problem.
Right.
And I think it's really up to white people to explain white privilege to white people.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
You know, and you know, and that way it really does make more sense to them, I think. You know, so it's our own self, our own contributions to the systemic racism that we have to become aware of and fight.
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Well, I would say, like, I think of Token and South Park, you know.
Oh, yes.
You know, the only black person in that little Mormon hill country in Colorado.
Yes. And, you know, the name happens to
and
be
everything
Tolkien.
It
is appropriate.
Yeah, right.
And you know, and Cartman is always the one who, like, has all of his prejudices, you know, fixated against poor Tolkien.
Oh,
including,
yeah.
Like, yeah. I mean, it's a great, like, way that popular culture kind of, like, destroys some of this stuff.
Puts that mirror up to us and goes, look, this is what you sound like.
Right. Let's see. And then something else, of course, that I can definitely tell you about me is, you know, I've been in art model since the mid-1980s. And, I mean, even though I've been modeling for that long, I never get tired of it. I mean, it's always interesting. In fact, actually today, later on this afternoon, I'm going to model for a class, and I've never ever had a situation like this before. I mean, I thought that I've seen it all, you know, but what's going to happen is the class is going to be, you know, like a it's going to focus on body image, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'll still be modeling, you know, and I'll still be nude, but and from what I understand, it's a, you know, a class of all women, you know, who had never drawn from a nude model before. And when I'm modeling, I'll actually be talking.
Oh, that's
to the class. That's very different. Very different. I've never had that experience before, you know, talking about my body, you know, my relationship to it.
Well, that sounds really interesting.
Yes.
Yeah, yes. Really does. Yeah. Let me know how that goes.
I definitely will.
Yeah.
Our society is so caught up on size and beauty and image and, you know, actually, we had this discussion in our Bi Men's group a couple weeks ago about size. And, you know, like, you know, my take is always how it changes based on the times that we're living in.
Right.
When we're in a baby boom, voluptuous women are attractive. When we're in a baby bust, big-fish women are attractive. You know, and how, you know, like, there was a great Onion piece a while back about, you know, how fat Marilyn Monroe was. And
oh, right.
How would she was attractive.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, yeah. And it is, like, how these things are, like, social constructs that we're, like, always facing. And the reality is that, you know, we're born into our bodies, and all of us are beautiful.
Oh, absolutely. Right? Absolutely.
And, you know, when we get fixated in, like, what we're supposed to love and not love, then it's just, you know, it's, a, you know, a cultural oppression.
Yes.
Yeah, and it is.
It hurts people who don't have that current model.
Oh, absolutely. And, I mean, I saw it, you know, loud and clear that this last year, as I was going through the, you know, cancer treatments and everything, and, you know, and still continue to model. And just backing up a little bit, let's see, I first had a lumpectomy in March.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it was like the middle of March. Well, first I was diagnosed with breast cancer in December 2013. In March, I had a lumpectomy where all the cancer was removed from my left breast. But they said that even though all of the cancer was removed, there were still all of these precancerous cells.
Right.
So they thought to be safe, you know, they'd better just go ahead and remove the breast, you know,
right.
Which scared the heck out of me. Well, I mean, the diagnosis alone scared the heck out of me.
Right.
But I'm so grateful that they caught it really early, you know, so I never had to go through chemo or radiation. But so they did a mastectomy the end of April with the purpose of reconstruction.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and during that time, I still continued modeling, and it was at first when I you know decided that I was going to continue modeling. At first, I thought I would just wear a bra, you know.
Right.
But then I thought that would almost draw more attention to the situation.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
So I went ahead and, you know, just modeled nude, as I always do. And it ended up being a teachable moment for everybody, because most people don't get to see someone who's gone through a mastectomy.
Yes. Yes. A very teachable moment.
Yeah.
And I applaud you for that.
Thank you.
It must have taken a little bit of soul searching for that.
Yes, so. Yes. Yes, a lot.
Good job.
Thank you.
Good job.
Yeah. I think that there was a project on the internet, I guess last year, which actually showed women of, you know, some who had mastectomies, double mastectomies, included in the, you know, in the pictures. And, you know, it was interesting to read the comments. I mean, some people were just horrified by what
gosh.
They saw. And,
wow.
And,
I know.
You know,
no.
And other people, like, were very supportive.
It
is the reality of our
yes.
lives.
Yes,
and,
exactly.
Like, women's breasts are a thing.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Yes.
And
one of my favorite photographs from that series was a woman who had tattooed across down her shoulder and across the incisions line and down, and it was just absolutely
gosh.
Stunning.
Oh,
it was
wow.
so stunning.
God.
And yeah, I really loved it.
Yeah, that's so great.
In our world, like, we have tattoo and henna artists who come in and, you know, not just with breasts, but also with the baldness that you get with chemo.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh, right.
Yeah.
Designs, you know, I mean, especially for girls. I mean, my son, like, he had his hat that
oh,
he wore
right.
all the time
uh-huh.
until the first fuzzy hair came back.
Oh my gosh!
Which his brother said, like, looked like a Jufro, which is like that's
oh, right.
whoa.
Cyclosporin. Your cyclosporin hair growth is like
yeah.
very like wild and frizzy, but.
And
you know,
fragile too, isn't it? It's very fragile.
Yeah, yeah. But for girls, it really is hard. You know,
oh,
when
yeah.
they lose hair. Years ago, when my son like cut off his long hair, the one who was in chemo,
uh-huh.
We gave Locks of Love, which is a place that, like, you know, gives wigs to like, especially girls.
Oh, gone. Right.
You know, one of the things that I think it's a problem for the bisexual community is
uh-huh.
that, you know, we're looked at as bisexual as a white thing.
Mm.
And nothing is further from the truth.
Right.
And, you know, how does our shared orientation differ in the biphobia that you see as a black woman?
Actually, I would say... Well, just, you know, going back a little bit, I would certainly say that, there's a similarity that I see between, my bisexual experience and my polyamorous experience, you know, because in, both situations, people see these communities as white. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so, and I mean, obviously, that's certainly not the case, but I would say that just in the you know rest of the world, I mean, you know, we're certainly in the minority, you know, as a black woman, you know, so So then when you have a minority of a minority, you know, basically, you know, a splinter group, you know, then I mean, you know, it certainly makes sense that there wouldn't be that many black women, you know, necessarily.
It is surprising that the numbers do show that a large part of the bisexual community is people of color, and you know, and the class issue and financial issues and things like that is a predominantly, we are all pretty much poor people, you know. So you know, I think that one of the things we need to, you know, make be more visible about is that we are such a diverse culture.
Yes,
and we are a culture, and you know, celebrate those things.
Oh, absolutely. And yet,
you know, and especially, you know, we need to talk about polyamory because it is one of our experiences that we probably handle better than a lot of other groups. Because I've said this before, there's polyamory in every group there is, every orientation. Mm-hmm. It just seems to be in the bisexual community. We are more in touch with it. We're able to talk about it a lot easier. So, you know, we can share those tools with people, mm-hmm. you know, yes. And it's important.
Oh yeah, and what I also find too is that a lot of people tend to assume that if you're bisexual, then you know, of course, you're also polyamorous,
right?
You know,
yes.
because you want to be with more than one gender, you know,
you have to be at
the same time,
right? You have to be. It must be the way it is.
Right.
I mean, like. Mike Huckabee actually had a whole speech about that last week. You know, about like, you know, well, first we allow gay marriage, and then the bisexuals are going to want to marry like one of each.
And you know, and I hear a lot of bisexuals going, okay. You know, but you know, for the majority of the people I know, they're monogamous.
Right.
I mean, you know,
yeah.
I had a wonderful lesbian friend of mine. I love her dearly. We went out and went to some kind of soiree, and she asked me, she was really joking. She goes, "So you're not into threesomes, huh?" And she was really being sarcastic because of the stereotype.
Right.
And I said, "Honey, I can't even handle a onesome."
Oh,
so.
No.
You know. Yeah, I know. It's just, you know, that's a, you know, a large part of it. But we do have a polyamorous community that, you know, thrives. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, and there's issues in there, too. But, you know, there's also a lot of really good things about setting up boundaries and honesty. And I think going to any relationship could use those things.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
And,
yeah.
You know, that's one of the things that I really like about being polyamorous and you know, having healthy relationships, you know, where we are honest with each other and, you know, we're able to set boundaries with each other. And now you had mentioned rules, and in the relationships that I'm in, we haven't really felt the need to, you know, set rules for each other. And it's kind of been my experience that people who are brand new to poly, you know, usually couples, mm-hmm. will tend to start out with a bunch of rules in order to protect their relationship, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
Kind of like a primer, you know, a primer kind of thing. This is what we need to set this up. And,
yeah.
But after you become involved, I guess you kind of like get to know what you should and shouldn't do.
Right, right. And, you know, and hopefully relax, mm-hmm. you know.
Right.
But it's just kind of been my experience, too, that, you know, well, I mentioned that I haven't really seen the need for rules in my relationships. And for me, the only time that I found, you know, rules to really be necessary is if, you know, if I don't trust my partner.
Right. Or if you don't know your partner, trust him. And if you don't trust him, maybe you shouldn't be there.
Right, exactly.
my own experience with polyamory or sexually could have been used as an example in a textbook on how not to be polyamorous.
Oh, my gosh.
We are all very closeted, hung onto our heterosexuality very deeply.
Right.
And that essential dishonesty kind of permeated into everything. I was really happy when I finally came out to myself last year, and I was able to learn what it really means to be polyamorous in the community, from the community. You know, like I said, about the things about respect, honesty, and boundaries are very, very essentials. Now, I still engage in romantic polyamorous relationships,
sure,
because they're very fulfilling.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they're very positive.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and so there is, you know, I have a few people that I'm in love with.
All right.
But we also have a very deep bond on another level too. That's almost unexplainable. So we just talked about that for a little bit. Is there anything you'd like to add
about polyamory or my?
Yeah.
Well, my relationship structure. Now I'm in a relationship with a man who I've been with for about 8.5 years, but the interesting thing is that I first saw him in 1998. I was sitting across from him. I was in a book group or a reading club or something like that, and the book that we were reading was The Ethical Slut.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And you know, which is you know, a well-known book, you know, basically a polyamory primer, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much. But I was sitting across from him, and he was with his new partner, who he's been with for, well, you know, since 1998. And you know, in fact, you know, they finally got married a couple of years ago, and I sang at their wedding.
Awesome.
Which was cool.
Yeah.
But so I first saw him in 1998, but it wasn't until 2006 that the time was right, and I, you know, finally told them that I wanted to date him. You know, so we've been dating ever since then. But he's married, and he also has another girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
And and then I still don't really know what to call him. I, you know, I always call him a, you know, more than a play partner.
Right.
Yeah. I've been in a relationship with him for a couple of years, and you know, and that's just, you know, been really wonderful too. And I find that we don't refer to you know, each other as, you know, primary or secondary relationships or anything.
Mm-hmm.
Like that. I mean, even though my boyfriend, he and his wife, I mean, I would say that's a primary relationship, you
mm-hmm.
know, because their, you know, lives are, you know, pretty entangled with each other, you know, and financially, insurance wise.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, but I've never felt, you know, secondary, quote unquote. You know, I've certainly never felt like I was less important than,
right,
than his wife. And especially last year when I was going through the cancer treatments, I mean, you know, his relationship with me, you know, was so important. I mean, you know, he went with me to the surgeries and, you know,
oh,
to some of my doctor visits, because it was just important for me to get well, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really is.
Because of all the, like, stereotypes about polyamory, we have a lot of, like, forces that do not want to talk about it. And, you know, like, 3, 2, 1. One of the problems within the bi organized community is dealing with polyamory within it, because for some it's seen as a stereotype that they want to, like, wipe out and say, well, most bisexuals are monogamous, so we can't talk about polyamory in the community.
Oh, my gosh.
So let's, you know, I mean, doing our best to, like, include all of our community.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how does your take on all that?
Yeah, well, You know, I don't know if it's more of a regional phenomenon or what, because, you know, I haven't really noticed that in the bi community here in the Pacific Northwest. I mean, there are monogamous bis, and, you know, but there are also, you know, of course, polyamorous bis as well. And I haven't really found anybody seeming to have a problem with it, or feeling like if you're bisexual and poly, that you're feeding into the stereotype. You know, I actually haven't heard anybody say that. But at the same time, my experience has been bisexuals who are monogamous feel like they're part of the minority.
But they're not.
Yeah. Right.
I guess it is regional here in the East Coast. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, people actually are apologetic when they talk about the fact that they're poly.
Really?
And,
yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things I've noticed is that, particularly in the gay community, it's like, let's look as normal as possible. So let's not talk about the lesbian community or the bears. Let's not talk about anything. Let's just present this same-sex couple with their kids. Mm. And it's, I don't think it's very healthy. I don't, because the diversity is, especially in the bisexual community, is what we are about.
Oh,
and you're leaving out a whole dialogue of people's experiences, and we're also about self-acceptance, and you cannot say, well, I'm bisexual, but there's this part of me that I can't accept. It's damaging, and, you know, we just need people to know there are experiences, healthy experiences out there that are not, it doesn't make you an evil person.
Right, exactly.
I really don't want us to fall into that same trap of because we are so much more diverse. We are. I mean, our gender diversity is incredible. You know, our racial diversity, everything.
Yeah.
You know, and it has to be embraced. You know, if we're going to be inclusive, if we're going to be intersectional, we have to do that, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean,
I was going to say that, you know, Brenda Howard, who, like, you know, the founder of the Mother of Pride and a founder of the bisexual community, was kink,
and
some of that is kind of like buried in her story by our own sometimes. And, like, you know, when I came into my local community, you know, it was very, very diverse with kink people and poly people and trans people, and, you know, I felt like a home because everybody was different.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
that's
and,
the same.
You know, like,
yes. Yeah.
Yeah, and like I feel like, you know, years later, some of that is kind of like, you know, whispered or dismissed or not really talked about.
Hmm.
You know? And when you start doing that, then you make it sound like it's something's wrong with it, and you're right, Gloria. On the West Coast, I don't see this issue. I really don't, because we're pretty open over here, especially Portland and Seattle.
Yes,
I mean,
yes.
We're pretty, as far as social structure, I think we've got a pretty good handle on it over here.
I think so.
Yeah, but yeah, I hear it online a lot too. It's like, oh no. You know, and it's like, oh, yes, yeah, of course, you know, because that is what the world is about. How can you teach diversity if you only show one face of it?
Right, exactly. Well, and I also think, too, that, you know, if there are bisexuals who have a problem with the people being poly, maybe it really depends on what their definition of polyamory is.
Exactly.
You know, because I'm, you know, I'm starting to think, okay, well, maybe they have this, you know, this really rigid notion of what it means, you know, and if that's the case, then, yes, I guess it would be problematic.
It would be, but, you know, the polyamory is so diverse in itself.
It is.
I mean, there's romantic relationships. You can have sexual relationships and one partner actually just be a romantic partner. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's all kinds of ways to express polyamory. Mm-hmm. And I think that teaching that is something that people need to understand.
Yes, you know. Yes, definitely.
Yeah. I think they might have skewed ideas about it, that it's just a bunch of people running around doing whatever.
Right. You know, and in some cases, you know, sure, that's correct, but you know, not all.
Too,
and that's totally, yes.
You know,
absolutely.
That's okay, too. You know, that's another issue, too, if we want to get just slut-shaming is another issue.
Oh,
that you know,
right.
Because, you know, when I was single and younger, because I'm still single now,
uh-huh.
when I was younger, you know, I had a lot of people I dated. We call them, you know, back then you called it F-buddies.
But, oh, right.
You know, and we had a good relationship. We were friends. We, you know, went and did stuff together, you know, and we just supported each other. It's not what people thought at all.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry. I'm talking about me, and I should be talking about you. I do have this really rather shallow question to ask because I've always been really curious about nude modeling.
Uh-huh.
And this question is always because I can't seem to shut my brain down ever. When you're posing and you need to remain still for long periods of time, uh-huh. do you have a process you go to reach zen, or do you just think about the big pile of laundry you have at home?
Actually, I would say probably a little bit of both. You know, because, well, for one thing, all of the different art classes, you know, the different groups where I've modeled, they tend to play, you know, really unusual music. And, mm-hmm. You know, and I really believe that, you know, the modeling is something that helped me to develop my eclectic taste in music. Mm-hmm. You know, because, I mean, you can basically hear anything, you know, classical music, you know, gangster rap, gospel, mm-hmm. you know, there have been very, very rare occasions where I would hear something that I absolutely did not like, but, I would just basically tune it out. And, mm-hmm. and to answer your question, I mean, I would be thinking about, you know, different things that I have to do, you know, kind of going through my to-do list, you know, maybe thinking about, you know, past conversations I had, you know, that, mm-hmm. maybe, you know, I could have said something differently.
Right.
And when I modeled a couple of days ago, I remember thinking about, these questions, you know, that I was going to be asked, you know, for the bycast, you know,
mm-hmm.
yes, you know, that thinking about my answers to the questions, you know? And yeah, that you know, definitely helps the time to go by really quickly. You know?
Yeah, I imagine so. Well, I'm glad to hear that. That you know,
it might be I'm different. It might be different for a male model because like a male model, like posing nude for hours, might have to think about baseball.
Yeah,
that's what I was going to say.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, baseball.
Something
oh, yeah, something's happening down there. You know, how many home runs did Babe Ruth hit in 1927?
Yeah. Ah, the joys of being male.
Oh, yes. Oh, gosh.
So we talked about your journey in the breast cancer.
Right.
But is there anything else you'd like to add about that?
Yes. I just want to really encourage everybody to make sure that they get regular mammograms because, I mean, if I hadn't gotten annual mammograms, there is no way they would have caught the cancer. You know, I was also doing the home, you know, self exams, you know, in the shower. But I mean, there's no way that I would have caught the cancer because there was really no lump.
Mm-hmm. You know? Exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, what happened was they, you know, I had my mammogram in December 2013. As I always do, and they called back and said that they saw something in the films that they didn't see the previous year, you know. Mm-hmm. So they wanted me to come back in, and that was when I found out, you know, that they found some cancer. And you know, it's one of those things that you think just happens to other people, you know.
Yeah.
So it was a complete shock. It was, you know, I hate to say wake up call, you know, because that's such a, you know, a tired, overused cliche, but that's exactly what the diagnosis was for me, was a wake up call. I ended up taking better care of myself as a result. Mm-hmm. You know, eating better, just
enjoying life better.
Definitely enjoying life better. Yeah. And also too, as a result of the diagnosis, you know, I realized just how short life is. And mm-hmm. You know, and I finally decided that I was no longer going to care about what people thought about me.
It's a very freeing and very little place to be, isn't it?
Yes, but yes.
it's great though. Yeah, and since then,
I'd add that you know, our health statistics for bisexuals, and especially for bisexual women, mm-hmm. show that we not do these screenings like we should.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I think you're an example of like why we really do need to like go to our doctor and get
yes.
our screening and
yes.
do
yes.
things that we all have to do.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, because you know, otherwise, you know, maybe by the time they found it would have been too late, you know, or it would have been, you know, really advanced stage. I mean, I didn't have to do the chemo or radiation, you know, which I'm so grateful
right.
for.
Yeah, my mom didn't either. They caught it very early.
Good.
Yeah. So, yeah, and you know, since then you've actually taken on some new hobbies and passions. You are now playing learning to play the ukulele, which
yes.
I just love. I love that.
Yes. Oh.
Now, have you played music before? Or?
Yes. Actually, I played the guitar since probably since my late teens, and mm-hmm. and then you know like you know for the last decade. Oh. But I've been playing the acoustic guitar since my late teens, and in fact, actually, the very first song I learned to play was "Don't Think Twice" by Bob Dylan.
Oh
and,
my!
And I don't know if I can still play that now. I probably can't. I definitely have to practice some more because I actually hadn't played guitar for the past, you know, like 10 years, and I'm just getting back to that too. But and since I, you know, play the guitar, you know, that made the ukulele, you know, an easy transition for mm-hmm. me. Yeah. And I'm having so much fun with it.
I think it's awesome. I think it's really awesome. Someday I may try, but I have like really small fingers. I tried to learn the piano when I was very young and probably wasn't a good idea then. And maybe I could do it now. But someday I'll learn. Yeah. And
small
I'm still
fingers
waiting
for are it. Good for Small fingers are good on a ukulele.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll try that.
Yeah, there you go.
So I wanted to talk about, let me pull up his name here. What is it, Tip?
Yeah, Tip Toland.
Yeah. I wanted to talk a little bit about the sculpture he did, and it's Mother Africa.
Or actually, Tip is a female.
Oh, okay. My mistake for even making that gender assumption to begin with.
Oh, no problem.
I'd like to talk about that beautiful sculpture she did.
Oh, my gosh.
Named Mother Africa. And is it still on exhibit?
No, it's not. I think it was on exhibit, you know, from like February to May of last year. And mm-hmm. I'm not really sure where it is right now. You know, I mean, I hope that Tip didn't disassemble it or anything.
I'm sure.
Yeah,
she can.
I'm sure. Yeah. But that was such an amazing experience for me. I've never had that happen before. You know, I've certainly been sculpted before, but you know, definitely not a, you know, a larger than life size sculpture, and
mm-hmm.
and especially, you know, representing Mother Africa.
Oh, it's absolutely gorgeous. We'll be putting a picture up of that and the link for her. So
yes,
yeah,
please do.
Absolutely.
Please do.
the New York Times article from last year.
Oh, yes.
How it, like, how it was so helpful to you. Because, like,
oh, yes,
within our community, it was a bit of a
controversy.
A
right, yeah. Right. And I know that there were a lot of people who just hated it.
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, I think a lot of it was the fact that there was a lot of focus on bi men in it. And,
yeah.
You know, like,
that did not.
Yeah, how.
But it had a lot of great information.
Right, right, it did. And, you know, what really, oh, it was like a eureka moment for me was when it talked about this study that these Cornell University students did, you know, where they were judging, you know, based on somebody's arousal factor, you know, and that you can be, you know, maybe aroused by, well, like in my case, you know, I'm certainly more aroused by women, but but I, you know, tend to get into romantic relationships with men.
Mm-hmm.
And being that it had been so long since I had been in a relationship with a woman, you know, for the longest time, I just considered myself a fraud, you know, and
right.
And figured, you know, well, I can't consider myself a card carrying bisexual anymore, you know, so I might as well, you know, rip up my card, you know, And but after reading that article and, you know, and reading about the arousal factor. You know, then it was like this light went off, you know, it was like, yeah, that's me. It was like I was finally able to explain myself, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's more about, it's not about behavior. It's about what attracts you.
Yeah.
Myself, I'm you know, very attracted to women sexually.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a lot of, and my relationship has been with men, but that has more to do with my severe need to prove I was heterosexual. But, you know, I would have had a lot more relationships with women if I had let myself. But, you know, and people ask, how do you know you're bisexual? And I said, well, you've got to just be in my head for like, you know, 5 minutes and you'll get it, you know.
Right.
And, you know, and even, you know, because I'm not really sexually active right now, but, you know, I just know.
You know, oh, yeah.
You just know.
You
and I know it was very validating for me, too, to realize that because I went through that, well, I can't really be bisexual because I haven't really had any experience, you know, or I'm not with anybody.
Uh-huh.
And it's really so much not that at all.
Right. Oh, yeah. I mean, if someone is celibate, I mean, do they stop being heterosexual or
Exactly, or gay, or
right.
You know,
yeah.
If I say, you know, does a priest stop feeling any kind of sexual attraction when he becomes a priest?
Right.
No.
No.
Unless, of course, he was asexual to begin with.
Oh, right.
You know, but you know, and you know, and there they get very confused about that with celibacy and asexuality too. So,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that's a whole total can of worms to open.
Oh, God.
Since I worked in a Catholic social justice group for 5 years, and like, you know, like volunteered 15 years before I worked for them, I will tell you that, like, within the celibate Catholic community, it's not always black and white. And, you know,
I mean, we had a
couple of nuns. I mean, a really Boston marriage, butch femme kind of relationship, where, you know, we never asked like what they did in bed together, but,
right.
You know, they slept in the same bed.
Wow.
And, you know,
well, you're getting you know, any conjecture there, but yeah.
You know, I mean, they were always good on the issues.
Yeah. Well,
you know,
it's like, I don't
you know,
really,
when it,
yeah.
You know, when we were like pushing, you know, ENDA and those bills way back when, they were always like, you know, the good nuns who like were the, you know, the Catholic troops that like were opposing the Vatican. So, you know, hey, I don't care, you know.
Yeah, I don't care either. I care about what kind of person somebody is. I don't care about anything else.
Yes, Yeah.
And that's what I'm really attracted to.
Yeah.
It's not really, and it really has very little to do with gender at all.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, but going back to the church, I mean, like, you know, the church was the place where, you know, non-conforming youth were put for many, many, many centuries.
Yes.
You know, like, when I got gay-bashed at, like, 11, it was because my gay buddy was being attacked.
Mm.
He went in the seminary, right?
Oh, my gosh.
And, you know, because that's where they put him, right? And, you know, it was because I was defending him and...
I think, well, yeah, I was going to say that they have, I think kids and predators have a sixth sense about children who think they're different.
Yes.
And so,
yes.
Don't you?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's
so,
true.
You know,
yes.
Yeah, they do.
I mean,
so.
That was a time which, like, that's how it played out. And, like,
mm-hmm.
yeah, and, you know, like, he was sent off to seminary because he was different. And, you know, I have, like, ton of, like, you know, gay and bisexual friends.
I have a question, though. If you're gay or you're bisexual male, would you not think that maybe not the best place to send your child, if you had a son who was, you know, you thought was gay or bisexual and you didn't want them to be, is not the seminary not the right place to send them?
Definitely not the right place to send them. Well, I mean, actually, that was just like in the 50s and 60s, where if you were a homosexual, you know, you would go to jail,
yeah,
which was probably the worst place to send you.
Yeah, because, you know, you segregated all male or
right,
all female.
Yeah.
It's like, well, maybe this isn't such a good plan.
No. Like, they obviously didn't think that through.
Well, and not even so much that I'm saying that you're going to have sexual activity there.
No,
That, you know, that what is that going to do to that poor kid's brain even more, to be even more exposed to, you know, his sexual feelings,
mm-hmm.
with kind of being surrounded by a man.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And that's pretty damaging.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, it was about being sent off because the alternative was to be destroyed.
That's
right?
True. Yeah.
So you know, and, you know, and the idea was that the church would protect the queer kids coming in. And, you know, yeah, and, you know, they did it the best they could. And, you know, we have, like, you know, a litany of scandals of all kinds of, you know, that it brought. But, like, overall, it was, like, a place, right? And,
mm-hmm.
you know, I was going to say that, you know, like, you know, being celibate doesn't really work for everybody.
No,
some
no.
people it does work for, you know, and, you know, that's great. Other people it doesn't.
No.
Well, I know for myself, yeah. It was something I absolutely had to do, and it wasn't for any religious reason at all.
Mm-hmm.
It was just for my own mental survival to figure things out.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm done with that now, you know.
Right.
I'm through that, you know.
Yeah.
So, Glory, is there anything you'd like to add right now?
Let's see. Oh, boy. Yeah, there is something that I want to add really quick about, you know, just some mistakes that I made in the past when I was, you know, new to polyamory.
Okay.
And that is, you know, at first, you know, I thought that, you know, jealousy was wrong. I mean, that was something that, you know, so many people would tell me, is that, you know, if you're poly, then, you know, you shouldn't experience jealousy. And I remember, this was several years ago, that I was dating somebody, and he was dating somebody else, and I, you know, told him that I was feeling really jealous. And now I wasn't telling him that, you know, he couldn't see this other person. You know, I mean, I, you know, certainly wasn't criticizing him or anything. I was just strictly talking about my feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And what he said to me was, gee, Gloria, you know, for a modern girl, you sure got some old-fashioned ideas.
Oh, so it didn't validate your feelings
and,
at all.
No, it's like, and I mean, first of all, jealousy is not an idea, you know.
It's a feeling.
Yeah, it's a feeling. And, you know, and, but he just totally invalidated that, you know. Mm-hmm. Another mistake that I made in the past is that I used to think that if your partner didn't want you to go out with somebody, then, you know, to keep the peace, you know, you had to, you know, cancel your date with this other person. Because I remember that happened to me several years ago when my partner saw this email that was up between me and somebody who I was going to go out with. I mean, you know, I think we were just going to go out and, you know, have some tea, you know. but he said to me, "I don't want you to go out with this person." Yeah, and so, you know, I thought, you know, it had no choice but to, you know, break my date. And anyway, well, first of all, there's no way that would come up now, you know, with the partner that I have now. I mean, we don't have that kind of a dynamic. But if it were to come up, I certainly would not cancel my date. You know, no. I would try to make my partner feel as comfortable as possible, and you know, and reassure him. And but I would still continue on with the, you know, my date with this other person.
Because you get into a scary little area there when people start dictating things to you and you try to keep the peace.
Yeah.
And that's not a good road to go down, guys.
No, it isn't.
Yeah. Awesome for you. Those are good. That's a very good tips. Thank you for that.
All right.
I can say that all links will be provided on our site.
Good.
And thank you for being here. It was a wonderful, wonderful interview.
All right.
Thanks a lot for showing up. And
thank you.
Giving your energy to us.
Thank you. This is
thank you. It was just fantastic. I can't wait to get them up for everyone.
Yes. Oh.
And we want you to come back anytime you want to.
Yes. I definitely will. This has been a great experience for me too. this is stuff that I always love to talk about. You know, so I never get tired of it.
So when the radio people start calling you up for an interview, you'll be able to go, "I can do that."
Yes. I'll feel more
comfortable.
Oh my gosh, well, that would be great.
We're just going to wrap up. I just want to remind everybody: you are not wrong, you are not broken, and you are not alone. You are a human being, and you are bisexual. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Don't.
Oh, gosh.
Oh, you play ukulele.
Yes.
Isn't that awesome?
It's a brand new hobby for me.
Oh, you know, it's big. It's big in my world.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
We have, like, our pool has actually a group of women who have a ukulele quintet sometimes.
Oh, really? Oh, my gosh.
Oh, yeah. They have, like, all sizes of ukuleles, some amplified, some not.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, some plastic, some, like, you know.
Plastic?
Like,
gosh.
Money that you, yeah, so much money that you can't even think about.
Oh, my goodness.
All righty. So let's talk her passion, like her ukulele, because you just started taking lessons recently, right?
That's right. And, you know, just recently became a passion of mine. And what originally happened was, last year, like the early part of last year, this chorus that I used to sing with, they said that they were starting a ukulele choir, and even though I wasn't part of the chorus anymore, you know, still that ukulele choir, you know, kind of intrigued me, you know. Yeah, so I wanted to join. I didn't have a ukulele at the time, and also I was still in the process of going through the cancer treatments, you know, which mm-hmm. we'll, you know, get into, you know, a little bit later, you know. But and also too, I realized that this particular ukulele group, you know, was going to be reading music, and that's something that I don't do very well, you know. Mm-hmm. So just the combination of all that, you know, I decided, you know, that I wouldn't join this ukulele group after all. But I still was really interested in it, and so I put an ad on Facebook, you know, in one of the kind of like free cycle groups, you know, mm-hmm. and just said that I was looking for a ukulele, and you know, and I was wondering if somebody had one that they no longer wanted, and you know, that if they wanted to gift it to me, and that was how I got my ukulele.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Wow. So, the views expressed on the Bicast do not necessarily represent those of Binet USA or the Bicast crew.
You bet that.